I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. The Park City Board of Education yesterday voted unanimously to put a bond before voters this November. In the studio to explain how much it's going to cost and where what the money will be used for, I have school board member Andrew Kaplan, joined by Todd Halber, the district's business administrator, the man who has done all the numbers here. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Andrew, start, if you would, by explaining the board's rationale to go forward with a bond this election. As part of the motion, if the bond isn't approved in November, then the school board will raise the tax levy to fund the facilities of the district.
Yeah, Leslie, thanks. We're pretty excited, I think, to be moving forward at this point. We have some serious facility needs that you and I have discussed on air before, and I think that the entire community is aware of. And, even if we start construction today, some of the buildings that we would be doing, such as the high school expansion, it would take about 3 years from start to finish. We need another elementary school that could take at least a year to get going. So even if we were to start today, which we're not going to do, but, we're still looking out several years. And, as of this coming fall, we'll have at least 4 schools with trailers due to overcrowding. Our elementaries are overcrowded. Treasure needs replacing. The board a couple meetings ago voted unanimously to move ahead with grade realignment. And so now we're dealing with the facilities issue to make sure that we have enough capacity for our students and good places for them to learn.
All right. Well, you said yesterday that you didn't want to see anything begin until next summer, summer of 2018. So does that mean that grade realignment would not start until after we have some facilities built?
Well, grade realignment is definitely not happening this fall. We decided that, and that was, due to input from our teachers as well as the community. And we looked at it logistically, and it didn't make a lot of sense for us. It was too difficult to pull off.
But we did talk about 18-19.
Exactly.
So it sounds like it needs to even 18-19
is still on the table. There's also some discussion around when construction would potentially start. There is a possibility that we could start construction on a high school expansion this June. That's a rather tight timeline because we would need to give architects direction basically this month. But again, that's going to be discussed at our next board meeting. And I think there's a bit of healthy debate on the board in terms of when that will start.
And there has been some discussion about this. I mean, so was a decision made to expand the high school or to look at building a new one?
What the decision that was made was to bond. The likely outcome is to do an expansion and renovation. The high school expansion committee gave us 2 recommendations, which were 3A and 4A. 3A keeps Dozier where it is. 4A moved Dozier Field. Those were kind of some of the main differences. 3A has the classroom wing to the south of the building. And that was, from what I understand from the committee, the overwhelming favorite, although they did do 2 recommendations. So it was about 2-1, as I believe, in favor of 3A. And I think because of the work that the committee put in, about 9 months of excellent work, the school board would be predisposed to following their recommendation. But again, that hasn't been decided.
All right. So are we still talking about $65 million? For either of those options, then?
Yeah, so those options are, I believe, $63 and $64 million, and that's the approximate cost of the renovation for the high school and the remodel. In addition to that, we would be bonding for a new elementary school, which has a price tag of approximately $30 million, and that would be the 5th-6th school. And what we aim to do is, much like the high school expansion process, we want to have a similar process involving the community, our faculty and staff, our parents, et cetera, in input into what that building looks like and ultimately where it's located. The recommendation from administration or from the curriculum committee is to have that building out on the Ecker campus. But again, the school board is open to discussing that versus potentially putting it on some of our other property, which includes our property at Bear Hollow. And then we also have another property at Silver Creek, which wouldn't be appropriate for the 5th-6th school. But we have both of those properties earmarked for elementary going forward. And
Neither of them are big enough for a high school, though.
That's correct. For a high school, we need a little over 50 acres to accommodate the high school facility as well as all the athletic fields. And so, you know, the bond is really three components, Leslie. It's the high school renovation, which, you know, again, is going to be around $65 million. It's an elementary school, which is around $30 million, and then a land component. And we're working, and actually Todd is running point on that, exploring what parcels of land are still available in the vicinity of our school district, which could accommodate that, you know, that size. And as you know, the development that's been here over the last 10 years has taken most of those off the table. And so in order for us to have the ability over the next 10 to 20 years in our district to deal with growth, regardless of what the growth assumptions are, if they're 1% or 3%, we may be there in 8 years, we may be there in 3 years, we may be there in 15. But what we want is for our district to have the ability to, should we grow, build another high school, have more elementary schools come online, have the opportunity for another middle school. So we don't get into a situation where we have to have large cohort schools. That can be a decision made by future boards in terms of the appropriate size of those institutions.
What do you mean large cohort?
I'm saying, you know, Ecker, for example, is around 800 students. You know, there are two sides of the academic debate about what the appropriate size is for a school, you know, a middle school or a lower elementary school. And I think as a district, we want to give ourselves options so that we don't end up with a school of 1600, for example, of, you know, for those kids. That's just not going to be good for anyone.
Yeah, you heard from the architects and contractors that were there about some reduced cost options to the high school remodel, dropping it down by about $15 million. What would you have to cut?
The main difference would be the athletic facilities. So and the CTE. You know, right now in the options we have, there's a very large addition to the west of the school, in between Dozier and the current school, that would accommodate an athletic facility, and two new gyms, as well as a large CTE space. We would be, instead of doing that, we would be putting the gyms where they are and just renovating them in the middle of the school. And we, you know, ultimately the flow wouldn't work as well. We'd be sacrificing, you know, square footage. You know, I think the difference was about 80,000 square feet that we'd be cutting.
So
from the plan.
Can the bond include costs of new buses in order to move along school start times?
The bond could, you know, I think that the board, you know, I brought that up actually as a possibility, to include. I think we'll probably try to keep the bond as clean and simple as possible. But it, you know, it is a potential thing to be included, you know, in a capital bond.
All right. So the rule is that you can bond up to a stated amount.
Mm-hmm.
What if the construction were to come in and over budget? You just use your capital funds.
We have a capital account balance of about $20 million, $21 million right now. And what we would do, and we discussed this with the architects and the GC, we would make sure that prior to digging or knocking any walls down, that we had a guaranteed cap on the construction that wouldn't happen.
Todd has prepared numbers for bond cost with $65,000, $100,000, and $140,000. Given just the needs you've explained to me, totally $95 million, are we even looking at a $65 million bond?
No, I don't think we are. I think we're looking either at the $100 million or above. And it depends on the availability or the perceived availability of land. And that's really the X factor in this, Leslie, is that, you know, essentially we have until August to list the bond and or to file exactly what items will potentially be paid for by the bond. And so we have until August to do the due diligence around the land. We hope to complete that a lot sooner. But that would be, you know, we have about $100 million of facilities, and then anything additional would be as a reserve so that we could buy land either right now or in the next 10 years.
All right. So for simplicity's sake, can we just cut the $65 million out of here for this discussion?
Yeah, I think we can.
Okay. So, Todd, let's talk about costs then. You've put the numbers, and you've got the calculator on the website if people want to do their own numbers.
That's right.
All right. So looking at a $100 million bond, what's this going to cost the average homeowner?
So for an average primary homeowner, that's about $205 a year.
Additional.
Additional. And for a secondary homeowner or a commercial property, it would be about $373.
Okay. And then up to 140, you've also done those $140,000 bond. You've also done those numbers?
Correct. And we've run those. So for that primary home, again, these are assuming the home value is at $650,000. Is just a little over $287. And then for that secondary home commercial property would be about $523.
Okay, additional into what we're already paying.
Correct.
Now, your motion, Andrew, yesterday said that if the bond doesn't pass in November, that the school board will consider a capital, a tax increase in the capital levy.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just talk about the timing of that, because the budget has to be approved in June, mm-hmm. at the latest, August, but you won't know until November sometime whether or not the bond approves. So how does that work?
Well, let me take a step back. What I'd say is that, you know, as a school board and as a district, we're unanimous in our view that, you know, we need new facilities. And so, you know, the previous bond failed, and that had a number of reasons. And I think there was a lack of community involvement in that. And as we move forward on the plans, you know, like we've incorporated the community in the high school planning, we will do the same in the planning of the 5th, 6th school. So what we want to do between now and November in the bond is answer any questions people have, take the input from the community, from our teachers, from our parents and our students, and make sure that the facilities that we're planning on building are acceptable to the majority of our community, which it wasn't in the past. And so that's our primary goal. What we mean by, you know, what I wanted to do in the motion is to make it very clear that as a board, we're committed to new facilities. And the most economic way for us all to do that is through a bond. We're very fortunate in that the state of Utah, you know, guarantees our municipal bond offerings. And so we have a very high credit rating when we do issuance. And interest rates are still low. They're going higher, but the cost of issuing a bond is much lower than going out and doing a tax levy for our community, as well as from a cash flow perspective. You know, we're the average home in our district is looking at a $200 increase versus if we were to do a levy, it would be about $1,400 or $1,500 a year for 2 years. And Todd also did a present value calculation, and I'm not sure if that's on the online calculator or not, but, you know, we're happy to discuss that with anyone. But again, if you look at the present value of that money, of the money that we would spend on the bond, or a taxpayer would spend on the bond versus a taxpayer would spend on the levy, again, the bond is a cheaper alternative than the levy.
And it means new growth paying its fair share as the growth comes on, as
exactly.
opposed to people who live here currently. But again, back to my question mm-hmm. in terms of the timeline. So you wouldn't increase taxes until following, not,
correct.
Not this upcoming
Sorry,
school.
Yes. So okay. So the bond would be in November. If I hope that this doesn't come to this, but if the bond were to fail, we would go to introduce a tax levy for the following school year. So the hearing would, the truth and taxation hearing would be in August
2018.
Yeah, August 2018. And then the funds would start to come in at the end of that year. So again, that kind of talks to our timeline and our ability to start construction, you know, this summer or next summer or, you know, and that's going to factor into our decision, certainly.
All right. You'll be taking public input at the meeting March 21st at 3:00 for working parents. How shall they give you input?
I've already received a couple emails, and I encourage anyone who has input positively or negatively to email the board. I'm happy to, you know, to collate those emails and post them on public record. Or, you know, we're happy to take phone calls. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, a lot of input on the buildings, the facilities, why are we doing this, et cetera. And, you know, as board members, we're happy to answer those. I'm always available. My email is, you know, is on the website, and I believe my phone number is as well, and happy to speak to anyone on that.
All right. So we don't see a repeat of 2015, a failed mm-hmm. bond election. I mean, you talked about the entire community being aware of it, but I think maybe they're not. I mean, if they don't read the paper, they don't listen to KPCW, how are they going to find
Well, I think everyone
out?
Listens to you, Leslie, at least your news hour. Wow. But no, that's a very fair question. We are going to have a massive campaign in terms of public awareness between now and November. And that's going to involve meeting at every school. It's going to be involving meeting the PTOs. It's going to be, it's going to involve having public town halls. And that's a commitment that we have to make as a board and as a district to educate people on what the options are, what the bond is going to look like, what the facilities will look like, and really what the economics look like. And it's a very simple calculation that people have to make about this bond is that, do you want to pay $200 a year for 20 years, or do you want to pay $1,500 a year for 2 years? And that's really what we're talking about. We're not discussing, are we going to move forward with new facilities? We are. The public will have a very large say in what those facilities look like, as they have with the high school. And I think the proof is in the pudding in that we are following the recommendation, or we are likely to follow the recommendation of the committee that spent 9 months on the high school. And we look forward to spending an equal amount of time and effort on the 5-6 school as well.
When do you decide about the bond language and the scope of what it would include?
That has to be done by August. I would say that as a board and as an administration, we would hope to have it done before that. But that would be the actual deadline to file.
All right. So, Todd, do you have all of these numbers now on the website then, that the cost for a primary homeowner, commercial business for both the bond and capital levy?
Yeah. So that information's out there. And again, you can go into the calculator. The calculator has the ability. So we've been talking generally about a $650,000 price. So when you look at numbers, that's what you're looking at. The calculator will let you put in your own home value. So you can go back to your last tax notice, drop that number in, and see what it will be for you personally. And that's the beauty of the calculator, is you can see what it will mean for you as an individual, and you can bring those ideas and thoughts to the public meetings.
And again, this amount is reduced by about 45%. I mean,
for a primary homeowner, exactly.
So we're looking at the taxable value, not what you would sell your house for in the market.
So when you use the tax calculator, you'll want to put in your market value, not the taxable value, because the calculator does the taxable value calculation for you. So do the market value.
Okay. Real quick, Andrew, start times were discussed. A very preliminary recommendation made by the transportation consultant that we should not institute a start time change this mm-hmm. coming school year. When are we going to get some more information, though, about?
We're going to have some more information at our next meeting. There should be a preliminary report for us then, mm-hmm. and we'll be discussing that in the public meeting. And, I think this is a project that both the community and the school board, the administration, are all behind. I think initially there were some questions about doing this along with realignment. But, as realignment's gotten pushed back, I think there's a strong desire from all sides to do this. The question is when can we implement it? And if the recommendation comes back from our transportation consultant that it's not possible this fall, I think we would start looking at the implementation for next fall as soon as possible, which includes the cost of buses. And Todd has already started to look at that with regards to our budget for next year.
But what you're waiting for is to find out how much time a kid would spend on a bus to get through the traffic that comes in on 248 and 224 mm-hmm. every day. So are those timelines going to be considered? I mean, because if they get to come on a bus maybe 20 minutes later to make up for the right now, they can pretty much zoom into town given the early hour. But if they're going to be in the thick of the traffic, then I don't know if there's going to be that much of a time savings. Has that been looked at?
Well, that's what the consultant is exactly looking at. And I would say also that we have an aligned interest with the city in looking at traffic. And that doesn't only go for changing start times, but that also goes for our new construction and what that means for the Kearns campus, what that means for, for other areas in the county and in the city. And, we will be working with the county and the city to address any traffic concerns and trying to mitigate any traffic growth.
Okay.
Yeah, and the consultant's been working directly with Alfred, with the city, getting that information so that dimension is totally understood.
And the board also made a decision to bring in 6 trailers for Treasure next year, as well as McPullen and other elementaries, or just those 2 schools?
So Parley's is going to have one, as of now.
Actually, the recommendation was for 4, and so we'll look at the needs at McPullen's, Treasure Mountain, and Parley's to figure out what the configuration needs to be. We want to make sure that as we look at the interior spaces that we're fully maximizing those before we go and put expenditure out for additional portables.
Okay. These cost, what, about $120,000 each?
Yeah, that's the rough cost. That's to take the original manufacturing and then put the snow load type roof on it.
And do we purchase them or do we just rent them?
So at this point, there aren't any on the market to rent, or if the ones that are on the market, well, I should say that they're not in condition to be brought up here. So we're looking at purchases. Also, we're exploring opportunities with some of our other neighboring school districts who are also in the mode of construction to see if we can work out some arrangement where we might do some cost sharing or some planning down the line.
Okay. Anything in the legislature we should be concerned about in these last 2 days?
Well, we should always be concerned until midnight on Thursday. Just yesterday, I had talked about Senate Bill 255. It's taken on a new complexure just in the last 12 hours. And so it's really, things are moving fast and move in curious ways.
Okay. Well, we'll bring you back to talk more about that. Andrew and Todd, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks.
From a 2-day training in Denver as part of the Climate Reality Project's Climate Leadership Training, in the studio with an update, City Manager Diane Foster, along with Environmental Sustainability Director Luke Carton. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So the training was fee, but you did have some airfare and lodging costs to pay for. What did you guys get out of the training?
Although Luke's was covered. Luke was one of the speakers, so they actually covered his cost as well. So it was probably the most economical training that anyone in any business could ever attend. Luke, would...
Yeah, the training was, it was impressive. I mean, the Al Gore walked through both his long presentation and also a shorter presentation on the most recent climate science. And then also the great thing is we actually got to rub elbows with Nobel Prize winning scientists and ask them questions and ask them, you know, what's going on, you know, what are the biggest things to watch for. And then the other part of it was, how do you communicate this story? How do you take some, you know, complicated climate science and make it digestible for folks? And the key is, you know, relate it back to yourself. But it was it was really impactful. It was interesting because at our table we also had a city council member from Lake Placid, another Olympic city, someone from the Tahoe region and that side. So it was really interesting to have these inner discussions as well of what we were learning and how to apply it.
All right. Well, my understanding is that now each of you who attended the training are supposed to go out and train 10 more people. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So what they do is they you get access to a ton of resources. And the goal is to just help kind of spread the climate science piece, answer questions that people may have. And also, but the other key is it's not a formal, you know, lockstep. Now you do this, then this and this. It's more, hey, how to engage people? How can you engage, you know, your family in understanding some of the latest climate science and some of the impacts, and also truthfully a lot of the opportunity side too. So it's very freeform, but yes, they want you to go out and talk to folks and just hear feedback, understand, you know, be a part of the conversation. Just don't sit on the sidelines.
Yeah. So will you set up those dog and pony shows then for the next few months?
Oh, we got dog and pony shows coming out of our ears, Leslie. We've got, even with our, so the interesting thing is even using the, we have a staff report this week about the municipal operations carbon footprint. And we're Celia Peterson, who is also at the training, my staff member, and I can work in some of the interesting pieces that might be able to relate back to, say, our water department or our transit department. Or you know, here's what's happening in the world of solar panels or battery storage, just to give them glimpses, and then how the city's goals tie into it. It's actually great because it gives us another level of information to be more engaging, to tie what we're doing here to a national and international level.
All right. Well, if we were to look at the 2016 carbon footprint, I mean, I opened up, saw a graph, and it looked like it's going up. We're not coming down.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So there are, and this is our first kind of to get in front of council, both to show them what we've done for the, and this is the municipal operation. So this is the city owned, operated, you know, our buses, library, that side of it. We're going to be rolling out a community wide one here in the next few months. And what we're looking at doing is, first of all, getting in front of council and saying, hey, here's what we've measured, here's where we're at. But also the other key is how can we, what's the best way to give this information to council and the community? Because it can get very wonky of scope one, scope two, scope three, all these other pieces. Easiest way to view it is half our footprint is buildings. Then we've got our transit fleet and our fuels for the other half. The interesting thing is when you start looking at what we've already got in the pipeline with electrifying our buses, 100% renewable, those pieces, we're actually on a good plan downward. And we also got some strong energy efficiency pieces going in as well.
All right. So you're convinced that we can get to net zero by 2022?
I am 100% positive we will get there. It's going to be tight, but we've got many things planned right now. The interesting thing is there's not any other city out there that's on this aggressive of a course, which is great. So we get to kind of choose our own path and see what makes sense. But we're definitely treading down a new path here, and it's exciting.
Yeah. So what's the situation with snowplows, electric snowplows?
Yeah,
is that ever a reality?
I'm actually glad you asked that. So we setting these ambitious goals. The great thing about it is we actually have companies reaching out to us on heavy equipment, which was always the tough nut to crack in my mind, because I said, all right, yeah, you know, there's electric sedans and even buses, but what do you do for these class 6 and class 8 chassis, you know, the big heavy equipment? The interesting thing is we already had two companies that are looking at doing prototype snowplows, because the thought is if they can drive the rough and tumble streets of Park City plowing snow, the real world applications for, you know, picking up trash and that side of it would actually be, it's easier. So this would actually be a very good test bed. And we're getting Troy Daly in touch with those groups to start saying, hey, we're interested in these types of this size equipment. And the great thing is we'll be able to try some of them out and get some real world applications for
them. Yeah, they should go to Lake Tahoe as well.
Yes.
And it is important to note, too, that we had in attendance the mayor, council member Andy Bierman, council member Becca Gerber, and council member Nan Worrell, as well as Luke, Celia, and myself at this. And to get to this energy goal, we're going to need not only our elected officials, which, you know, that's, I think it's a huge leadership commitment on their part to have done, spent 3 days on this, at this training, but also we're going to need the whole community. So Andy actually is responsible for having organized a lot of this, and he's talking to the folks from Climate Reality and former Vice President Gore about coming out and doing this training in Park City so we can get the whole community trained in this. And I'll tell you, I was floored. Al Gore actually did 60% of the training, so we can quite literally say we were trained by Al Gore.
And you got a shout out that we're about our net zero goals.
Yeah, we did actually. Believe it or not, we were one of the first communities ever recognized by Climate Reality Project for the work that Park City's been doing. So it was great to shake his hand and get a plaque. And also, yeah, they gave us quite a few shout outs, which was impressive.
And to see Luke and Ski Butler's CEO Bryn Carey on stage for a panel and talking about kind of how we're getting there.
Okay, got lots to get through. Let's just blow through some of this real quickly here. The city employee housing policy, we're going to want some direction from council whether or not we see more city employees live within the city limits. Is that the idea here?
That's exactly the idea. When we think about things like emergency services, if we have an earthquake and the roads aren't accessible and all of a sudden we don't have people to provide emergency response services, that's one of the considerations, as well as just, you know, the city takes very seriously its role as an employer. We're like the fourth largest employer in town, and if we're asking other people to house their employees, and please note that the city's done a ton already, and a good number of city employees do live in either affordable housing, et cetera. This is just looking at where we're going for that 800. Our goal is 800 new affordable units in 10 years, looking at our employee piece of it.
Yeah. So how many of those 800 units would be for city staff?
It'd be a small percentage. I don't think you're going to see what you're seeing staff ask for here is up to 5 2 to 3 bedroom townhomes or single family detached, up to 5 2 or 3 bedroom townhomes or condos, and an additional 46 seasonal studio apartment style units. So not a sizable percentage, but however, it's definitely a huge step.
Yeah, as the council looks later on in the meeting about the whole Main Street Plaza subdivision action, was that ever considered as an affordable housing site and just dismissed?
It was discussed as an affordable housing site. What City Council very much has said is we want to create vibrancy in that space and we want to bring people to Upper Main Street. So that's how that discussion went.
Putting units would bring people up there, but you
want to bring
the
people who
crowds.
Live there. But yeah. It's the idea of bringing vibrancy and that economic draw to the top end of Main Street.
All right, let's see the discuss with regard to the parking infrastructure RFP that has been issued. What are we looking for here? Somebody who can put into place what the council is hoping for with the demand-based parking system?
Yeah, and I would tell folks, if you're interested in this topic, we're going to have the head of Dixon, who's our consultant on this. So we have hired a company that has worked with organizations and worked with cities like Palo Alto in installing these systems, because it's not just the technology, it's actually the processes that you put in place, the pricing you put in place, and the communications you do to things like the Main Street businesses, which we have been doing, and we will continue to increase the volume, frequency, and channels on those.
And is this possible that, because we're talking with a June 1st start, is that possible that this could happen?
We're talking about a soft launch, and I will say it's going to be very important. We have the RFP out for, the RFPs going out for the vendors for the hardware. If they come back and say July 1st, we're going to have to work with them on that. So I wouldn't say, you know, expect it to be fully operational by June 1. That's a target date right now, and we have to see what the hardware comes in at.
All right. And a meeting that anybody has any concerns about, Sundance 2017 should come and be part of this at 5:30, debrief. What do we know about Sundance 2017? I mean, we had heard larger crowds. We had more traffic, you know, the whole lower Main Street being closed off. So what is it that you want to get out of this?
What we want to get out of this is feedback from City Council and where they want us to make tweaks. You know, I think overall, if you talk to most people, the Sundance 2017 Film Festival was a resounding success from the perspective of, we had unprecedented challenges between snow and the Women's March on the first Saturday, which is historically the biggest day of Sundance. And all in all, it went pretty well. So I think it's a, what things can we do to make improvements to that? Can we look at further mitigation of keeping traffic out of the residential neighborhoods? That's definitely something that, that staff wants to look at. Are there things we can do with permitting that are different? And it's important to remember, though, that we remind ourselves that it's not just Sundance. It's all the other organizations that come here that aren't affiliated with Sundance that are, that it's, you know, Sundance causes the impacts, but it's not just Sundance either.
Yeah, with this whole deal with outdoor retailer leaving Utah, there was also speculation, oh, Sundance too, you know, just for perhaps political purposes. But that really can't happen because we've got a long-term agreement, right, for them to be here?
It could happen. We do have a contract. I think it's 2022 with an extension to 2026. You know, it's Sundance could be lured away. Is that, do I think that's going to happen tomorrow? Absolutely not. Do I think Sundance is saying, oh, you know, we need to leave Park City? I don't think that's the case either. However, we always do have to make sure we honor that relationship, and we do, and that we appreciate what we do have in Sundance. It is part of who we are and part of our brand. It was interesting when Al Gore was giving the award to Mayor Jack Thomas for the work that the city's doing on energy. He referenced the Sundance Film Festival. Obviously, he had a film in it this year, and he's had a film in it before. But it is, if you look, even Fitch ratings and Moody's, if you look at the bond ratings, they include Sundance in their descriptions of what Park City is.
All right. Real quick, we need to mention this. The council will consider whether or not to approve the second option payment of $1.5 million to Redis Park City LLC for the purchase of Bonanza Flat. This is a non-refundable decision, right?
That is a non-refundable decision. We've already given $1.5 million that's non-refundable. And this question is, should City Council go ahead and do the next $1.5 million payment? If we don't end up closing on the property, then we would lose $3 million. Staff is recommending moving forward. I think with the support we've had from Summit County, the discussions with Salt Lake Public Utilities and Salt Lake County, as well as the private fundraising that Wendy Fisher has led and Cheryl Fox at Summit Lands has supported, I think we think we're going to get close. Do we still need help? Absolutely. And it's every dollar counts in this campaign.
Yeah. And I've heard we're up to about $32 million. But again, that still sounds like some of it's just being pledged and not, you know, check in hand.
I think we're. That's true. Sorry. I was just doing the math in my head. And until we actually get a vote from the Salt Lake County Council and until we get a vote, until the Salt Lake City Council votes, those aren't committed dollars. And we don't know, actually, while Council Member Andy Bierman and Mayor Jack Thomas have been having constant discussions with their partners in other areas. And I will say that this is one of the benefits of the Mountain Accord process, is that I don't think before Mountain Accord that that we would even think that these folks, we wouldn't have even thought to go ask them for money. And so it's been a nice side benefit.
All right, Diane Foster, Luke Carton, thanks for your time. KPCW News Time now, 8:48. Good morning. The Summit County Health Department concerned about the growing number of cases of prediabetes and is hosting a Diabetes Alert Day giveaway going on now through March 28th. In the studio to explain, I have Derek Sidaway, Health Department PIO, along with Serene Brooks. She's the department's health educator. Good morning.
Good morning.
Serene, let's start with you. Let's talk. What is prediabetes and how would you know if you have it?
Okay, so prediabetes is when your blood sugar levels are higher than normal, but they're not high enough to be diagnosed as diabetes. And it is an actual diagnosis, which is fairly a fairly recent thing. It used to be that people that had high blood sugars just said, oh, your sugar levels are a little high. We'll just wait till you have diabetes, and then we'll decide how to manage that. Now they're realizing that there's a lot of things you can do. And so we're trying to raise awareness for people to go and see if they are at risk for diabetes, maybe already have prediabetes, and so that they can prevent getting diabetes.
Yeah. So what's high?
So high, it's diagnosed by a blood test called an A1C test. And high would be anything over, between 5.7 and 6.4 on an A1C test. So normal would be below 5.6. And that's a test that you would ask for at the doctor's office if you're having a routine physical. You can ask to have an A1C test done if they aren't going to do one. And then the important thing is to follow through and find out what the results of that test were.
All right. So how is it caused? I mean, is it just eating a lot of sugar?
There's a lot of risk factors for diabetes. And some of them you can't control. So they would be things like age. So the older you get, the more at risk you are for diabetes. Other things like ethnicity and family history. So if you have a parent or grandparent who had type 2 diabetes, you're just more at risk to have it. However, there are things that you can control that contribute to getting diabetes. One of them is your amount of physical activity that you participate in during the week. So it's been proven that as little as 150 minutes a week of physical activity can prevent diabetes. And that would mean things like just taking a brisk walk. So it's not anything intense. It's a brisk walk, and that's about 20, 30 minutes a day is all. The other thing you can control is maintaining an appropriate weight. So for those who feel like they need to lose weight, as little as 5% weight loss has been proven to reduce the risk of getting diabetes.
And why do we not want this? I mean, this is something that's brought on. It's not something you're born with. It's something that you bring on yourself. So why is it such a bad thing?
So diabetes nearly doubles your risk for heart attack and stroke, and it is the leading cause of kidney failure. And so if there's any way you can prevent ever having diabetes, then you definitely want to do it. It would be worth the effort right now to prevent it than the effort later on to manage it. And that being said, those who already have type 2 diabetes, just having diabetes isn't what causes the risk of these health problems. It's having high blood sugar levels that are not managed. So if you have diabetes right now, the important thing is just to find out how you can manage those blood sugar levels and keep them down to a safe level, which, going back to the A1C test we said earlier, is around about a 7. They say if you're down to about a 7 in your A1C, your blood sugar levels are low enough at that point to not cause damage to your body.
All right, Derek, the county is hosting Diabetes Alert Day giveaway. What's this?
So in an effort to kind of raise awareness for all the things that Serena's just talked about, we're holding a promotion from now until March 28th, which is Diabetes Alert Day. And what you can do is go to summitcountyhealth.org/diabetes-alert. And when you get there, there'll be more information, and then you can also see the different ways you can enter into the contest. So the first thing that you'll have to do, the kind of the two mandatory ways you have to enter, is one, tell us where you're from, your location. We have a few area-specific prizes that we're giving away. And then the second one is just check out the Health Department Facebook page. From there, we have a bunch of different options, like I mentioned, taking the prediabetes risk test and then also visiting some of the websites of our partners. So we're very grateful to be working with the South Summit Aquatic Fitness and Rec Center, the Basin Rec Center, and the Park City Mark. They've all partnered with us to help raise awareness, and they're giving away a variety of different rec center passes. So we're very grateful to be working with them for that. The prizes also include 2 Fitbit Flexes, which people can win. And once again, all you need to do is go to that website, summitcountyhealth.org/diabetes-alert, and all the info will be there.
And how much of the information that people are giving as part of this data collection is the county seeing?
So when you take the prediabetes risk test, you'll give us back a link. We don't see any of your results to the test, so that's completely private. We just need proof that you've taken it, so we're not keeping any of that information. The only thing we will collect is your email address. One of the options is to join our health newsletter, and so we'll collect your email address for that. But other than that, everything is completely private.
All right. Again, you're just going to do a drawing then on March 28th?
Mm-hmm. So you can enter up to 12 different times, and then when March 28th comes, we'll do the drawing, and we will announce the winners that day.
Okay. Anything else people should know?
I think that's about it. We just want to encourage people to get out and to participate and to kind of be mindful about some of these things.
All right. Derek and Serene, thanks for your time this morning. 8:56. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. On the phone with me from the Park City Museum, Director Sondra Morrison. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, you've got a number of events coming up that you wanted people to know about. What's coming up first?
We do. So this Thursday, March 9th, we have a lecture in our Tozer Gallery, and everybody's heard of the Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History, but you might be unsure of exactly who or what this group is. So we have co-chairs Sally Elliott and Rory Murphy joining us at 5 o'clock for a presentation, talking about the historic mine structures that are on the ski resorts and what this group is doing to help preserve those.
Okay. It's free or it's a fundraiser?
No, it's free. Yep. Okay. Yep. Come on by and learn more about our mining structures and what you can do to get involved, yeah.
All right. And then next Tuesday, you've got the Oregon Trail Lectures as part of one of the exhibits?
No, actually, we don't have a traveling exhibition right now, which gives us the luxury of holding these lectures in the Tozer Gallery. So, you know, we can fit 50 and 60 people, which normally when we do the lectures up in our conference room, we can only fit about 30. So we're taking advantage and just doing some different lectures. The Oregon Trail one is Dorian DeMayo, and he's an avid pilot and a number of years ago followed the Lewis and Clark Trail and gave us a presentation about that. This time he's followed the Oregon Trail, and so, pretty much telling that story of the pioneers, which is, you know, sort of pre-Park City history, but again, similar experience.
Okay, again, that's March 14th, I believe. And then on Monday, March 20th at 5 to 6, you've got a train adventures lecture. Tell me about that.
Right. So local historian David Nicholas is an avid railroad historian, and he discovered Dick Steinheim's collection of photographs. Dick was a photographer and railroad buff, and he traveled from Ogden to Park City on the railroad back in the 50s and took a number of, you know, really intriguing photographs of Park City in the 1950s, which you can imagine are a town basically no economy and crumbling to the ground. So that'll be just a great visual experience for everybody, obviously, and we'll be able to project those images. Dick actually wrote over 10 books about different railroads in the U.S., and of course, his photographs were featured in, you know, every railroad magazine out there. He was so well-known and such a wonderful photographer.
All right, and mark your calendars for June 24th. That's the annual historic home tour. Anything else, Sandra?
And then we have our new traveling exhibition will be coming to the Tozer Gallery in April, and it's called Spirited. It's about prohibition.
Okay. Hey, thanks for your time.
Yeah. Thank you.